Hi, listeners. This is the Governor. Welcome to Mosh Pod.
Mosh Pod.
This is the second episode on dodgy practices. We found so many good pods informing us about how dodgy we are as a species that we had to spread it over three episodes. We have four great pods for you guys today. One, a story of corporate greed and ambition gone mad. Another, about what the pharmaceutical companies are trying to hide from us. And the last pod, a tale of revenge and getting back at the African scammers. But today we start with a lamentable tale of self-loathing and business malpractice. This well-written tale of woe, entitled The 400-Pound CEO, tells the story of a fat man. A fat man whose only joy in life is obtained by masquerading as a good guy, while being involved in raccoon, trapping, murdering, fraud. See what dodgy business practices are involved in this entertaining story that makes us wonder. Do we really see fat people like that? Is that how we really treat fat people? Is that a dead raccoon in your pocket, or are you just really, really fat? It's a kind of story I wish ended a few minutes before it does. Taken from This American Life, number 51, Animals Die, People Ponder, Act 2, The 400-Pound CEO.
At noon, another load of raccoons comes in and Claude takes them out back of the office and executes them with a tire iron. Then he checks for vitals wearing protective gloves. Then he drags the cage across 209 and initiates burial by dumping the raccoons into the pit that's our little corporate secret. After burial comes prayer, a personal touch that never fails to irritate Tim, our ruthless CEO. Before founding Humane Raccoon Alternatives, Tim purposely backed his car over a frat boy and got 10 to 12 for manslaughter. In jail, he earned his MBA by designing and marketing a line of light-up Halloween lapel brooches. Now he gives us the brooches as performance incentives and sporadically trashes a bookshelf or two to remind us of his awesome temper and of how ill-advised we'd be to cross him in any way whatsoever. Post-burial, I write up the invoices and a paragraph or two on how overjoyed the raccoons were when we set them free. Sometimes I'll throw in something about spontaneous mating beneath the box elders. No one writes a better misleading letter than me. In the area of phone inquiries, I'm also unsurpassed. When a client calls to ask how their release went, everyone in the office falls all over themselves, transferring the call to me. I'm reassuring and joyful. I laugh until tears run down my face at the stories I make up regarding the wacky things their raccoon did upon gaining its freedom. Then, as per Tim, I ask if they'd mind sending back our promotional materials. The brochures don't come cheap. They show glossies of raccoons in the wild, contrasted with glossies of poisoned raccoons in their death throes. You lay that on a housewife with perennially knocked over trash cans and she breathes a sigh of relief. Then she hires you. Then you get a 10% commission. These days, commissions are my main joy. I'm too large to attract female company. I weigh 400. I don't like it, but it's beyond my control. I tried running and rowing the stationary canoe and hatha yoga and belly staples and even a muzzle back in the dark days when I had it bad for Frida, our document placement and retrieval specialist. When I was merely portly, it was easy to see myself as a kind of exuberant sportsman who overate out of lust for life. Now no one could possibly mistake me for a sportsman. When I finished invoicing, I enjoy a pecan cluster. Two, actually. Claude comes in all dirty from the burial and sees me snacking and feels compelled to point out that even my sub-rolls have sub-rolls. He's right, but still it isn't nice to say. Tim asks, did Claude make that observation after having wild sex with me all night? That's a comment I'm not fond of, but Tim's the boss. His t-shirt says, I hold your purse strings in my hot little hand. Ha-ha, Tim, says Claude, I'm no homo. But if I was one, I'd die before doing it with Mr. Lard. Ha ha, says Tim, good one. Isn't that a good one, Jeffrey? That's a good one, I say glumly. What a bitter little office. My colleagues leave hippo refrigerator magnets on my seat. They imply that I'm a despondent virgin, which I'm not. They might change their tune if they ever spoke with Ellen Burtomley regarding the beautiful night we spent at her brother Bob's cottage. I was by no means slim then, but could at least buy pants off the rack and walk from the den to the kitchen without panting. I remember her nude at the window and the lovely seed helicopters blowing in as she turned and showed me her ample front on purpose. That was my most romantic moment. Now for that kind of thing, it's the degradation of Larney's consenting adult viewing center. Before it started getting to me, I'd bring bootloads of quarters and a special bottom cushion and watch hours and hours of Scandinavian women romping. It was shameful. Finally, last Christmas, I said, enough is enough. I'd rather be sexless than evil. And since then, I have been. Sexless and good, but very, very tense. Since then, I've tried to live above the fray. I've tried to minimize my physical aspects and be a selfless force for good. When mocked, which is nearly every day, I recall Christ covered with spittle. When filled with lust, I remember Gandhi purposely sleeping next to a sexy teen to test himself. After work, I go home, watch a little TV, maybe say a rosary or two. 30 more years of this and I'm out of it without hurting anybody or embarrassing myself. Sadly, I find my feelings for Frida returning. I must have a death wish. Clearly, I repulse her. Sometimes I catch her looking at my gut overhangs with a screwed-up face. I see her licking her lips while typing, and certain unholy thoughts go through my head. I hear her speaking tenderly on the phone to her little son, Len, and can't help picturing myself sitting on a specially reinforced porch swing while she fries up some chops and Len digs in the muck. Today, as we prepare Mailer, she says she's starting to want to be home with Len all the time. But there's the glaring problem of funds. She makes squat. I've seen her stub. There's the further problem that she suspects Mrs. Rasputin, Len's babysitter, is a lush. I don't know what to do, Frida says. I come home after work and she's sitting there tipsy in her bra, fanning herself with her racing form. Before I know what I'm saying, I suggest that perhaps we should go out for dinner and offer each other some measure of comfort. In response, she spits her tab out across her cubicle. She says now she's heard it all. She goes to fetch Tim and Claude so they can join her in guffawing at my nerve. She faxes a comical note about my arrogance to her girlfriend at the DMV. All afternoon, she keeps looking at me with her head cocked. Needless to say, it's a long day. Then at 5, after everyone else is gone, she comes shyly by and says she'd love to go out with me. She says I've always been there for her. She says she likes a man with a little meat on his bones. She says, pick her up at 8 and bring something for Len. I'm shocked. I'm overjoyed. My knees are nearly shaking my little desk apart. I buy Len a football helmet and a baseball glove and an aquarium and a set of encyclopedias. I basically clean out my pitiful savings. Who cares? It's worth it to get a chance to observe her beautiful face from across a table without Claude et al. Hooting at me. When I ring her bell, someone screams, come in. Inside, I find Len behind the home entertainment center and Mrs. Rasputin drunkenly poring over her grade school yearbook with a highlighter. She looks up and says, where's that kid? I feel like saying, how should I know? Instead, I say, he's behind the home entertainment center. He loves it back there, she says. He likes eating the lint balls. They won't hurt him. They're like roughage. Come out, Len, I say. I have gifts. He comes out. One tiny eyebrow cocks up at my physical appearance. Then he crawls into my lap holding his mega death dealer by the cowl. What a sweet boy. The dealer's got a severed human head in its hand. When you pull a string, the dealer cries, you're dead and I've killed you, Prince of Slime, and sticks its day-glow tongue out. I give Len my anti-violence spiel. I tell him only love can dispel hate. I tell him we were meant to live in harmony and give one another emotional support. He looks at me blankly, then flings his death dealer at the cat. Frida comes down looking sweet and casts a baleful eye on Mrs. Rasputin, and away we go. I take her to Aces Volcano Island. Aces is an old service station now done up Hawaiian. They've got a tape loop of surf sounds and some Barbies in grass skirts climbing a papier-mâché mountain. I purposely starve myself. We talk about her life philosophy. We talk about her hairstyle and her treasured childhood memories and her paranormally gifted aunt. I failed to get a word in edgewise, and that's fine. I like listening. I like learning about her. I like putting myself in her shoes and seeing things her way. I walk her home. Kids in doorways whistle at my width. I handle it with grace by shaking my rear. Frida laughs. A kiss seems viable. It all feels too good to be true. Then on her porch, she shakes my hand and says, great, she can now pay her phone bill, courtesy of Tim. She shows me their written agreement. It says, in consideration of your consenting to be seen in public with Jeffrey, I, Tim, will pay you, Frida, the sum of $50. I take a week of vacation and play Oil Can Man nonstop. I achieve level 9. At the end of night 3, I step outside for some air. Up in the sky are wild clouds that make me think of Tahiti and courageous sailors on big sinking wooden ships. Meanwhile, here's me, a grown man with a joystick burned on his thumb. So I throw the game cartridge in the trash and go back to work. I take the ribbing, I take the abuse. Someone snipped my head out of the office photo and mounted it on a bride's body. Tim says, what the heck, the thought of the visual incongruity of our pairing was worth the $50. Do you hate me? Frida asks. No, I say, I truly enjoyed our evening together. God, I didn't, she says. Everyone kept staring at us. It made me feel bad about myself that they thought I was actually with you. Do you know what I mean? I can't think of anything to say, so I nod. Then I retreat moist-eyed to my cubicle for some invoicing fun. I'm not a bad guy. If only I could stop hoping. If only I could say to my heart, give up. Be alone forever. There's always opera. There's angel food cake and neighborhood children caroling and the look of autumn leaves on a wet roof. But no, my heart's some kind of idiotic fishing bobber. My invoices go very well. The sun sinks, the moon rises, round and pale is my stupid face. I minimize my office time by volunteering for the Carlisle entrapment. The Carlisles are rich. A poor guy has a raccoon problem, he sprinkles poison in his trash and calls it a day. Not the Carlisles. They dominate bread routes throughout the city. Carlisle supposedly strong-armed his way to the top of the bread heap, but in person he's nice enough. I let him observe me laying out the rotten fruit. I show him how the cage door coming down couldn't hurt a flea. Then he goes inside and I wait patiently in my car. Just after midnight, I trip the wire. I fetch the Carlisles and encourage them to squat down and relate to the captured raccoon. Then I recite our canned speech, congratulating them for their advanced thinking. I describe the wilderness where the release will take place, the streams and fertile valleys, the romp in the raccoon's stride when it catches its first whiff of pristine air. Mr. Carlisle says thanks for letting them sleep at night sans guilt. I tell him that's my job. Just then the raccoon's huge mate bolts out of the woods and tears into my calf. I struggle to my car and kick the mate repeatedly against my wheel well until it dies with my leg in its mouth. The Carlisles stand aghast in the carport. I stand aghast in the driveway, sick at heart. I've trapped my share of raccoons and helped Claude with more burials than I care to remember, but I've never actually killed anything before. I throw both coons in the trunk and drive myself to the emergency room, where I'm given the first of a series of extremely painful shots. I doze off on a bench post-treatment and dream of a den of pathetic baby raccoons in V-neck sweaters yelping for food. When I wake up, I call in. Tim asks if I'm crazy, kicking a raccoon to death in front of clients. Couldn't I have gently lifted it off, he asks, or offered it some rotting fruit? Am I proud of my ability to screw up one-car funerals? I tell Tim I'm truly sorry I didn't handle the situation more effectively. He says the raccoon must have had a sad last couple of minutes once it realized it had given up its life for the privilege of gnawing on a shank of pure fat. That hurts. Why I continue to expect decent treatment from someone who's installed a torture chamber in the corporate basement is beyond me. Down there he's got a hide-a-bed and a whip collection and an executioner's mask with a built-in Walkman. Sometimes when I'm invoicing late, he'll bring in one of his willing victims. Usually they're both wastel. I get as much of me under my desk as I can. Talk about the fall of man. Talk about some father somewhere being crestfallen if he knew what his daughter was up to. Once I peeked out as they left and saw a blonde with a black eye going wherever Tim pointed and picking up his coat whenever he purposely dropped it. How do people get like this, I thought. Can they change back? Can they learn again to love and be gentle? How can they look at themselves in the mirror or hang Christmas ornaments without overflowing with self-loathing? Then I thought, I may be obese, but at least I'm not cruel to the point of being satanic. Next day, Tim was inducted into Rotary, and we all went to the luncheon. He spoke on turning one's life around. He spoke on the bitter lessons of incarceration. He sang the praises of America and joked with balding sweetheart ophthalmologists, and after lunch hung his Rotary plaque in the torture chamber stairwell and ordered me to Windex it daily or face extremely grim consequences. Tuesday, a car pulls up as Claude and I approach the burial pit with the Carlisle raccoons. We drag the cage into a shrub and squat panning. Claude whispers that I smell. He whispers that if he weighed 400, he'd take into account the people around him and go on a diet. A pale girl in a sari gets out of the car and walks to the lip of the pit. She paces off the circumference and scribbles in a notebook. She takes photos. She slides down on her rear and comes back up with some coon bones in a baggie. After she leaves, we rush back to the office. Tim's livid and starts baby oiling his trademark blackjack. He says no more coons in the pit until further notice. He says we're hereby in crisis mode and we'll keep the coons on blue ice in our cubicles and if need be wear nose clips. He says the next time she shows up, he may have to teach her a lesson about jeopardizing our meal ticket. He says animal rights are all well and good, but there's a big difference between a cute bunny or cat and a disgusting raccoon that thrives on carrion and trash and creates significant sanitation problems with its inquisitiveness. Oh, get off it, Claude says, affection for Tim shining from his dull eyes. You'd eliminate your own mother if there was a buck in it for you. Undeniably, Tim says, especially if she knocked over a client trash can or turned rabid. Then he hands me the corporate visa and sends me to Hardware Niche for coolers. When I get back to the office, everyone's gone for the night. The Muzak's off for a change, and loud whacks and harsh words are floating up from the basement via the heat ducts. Before long, Tim tromps up the stairs swearing. I hide pronto. He shouts thanks for nothing and says he could have had more rough and tumble fun dangling a cat over a banister, and that there's nothing duller than a clerk with the sexual imagination of a grape. Document placement and retrieval specialist, Frida says in a hurt tone. Whatever, Tim says and speeds off in his Porsche. I emerge, overwhelmed, from my cubicle. Over her shoulder and through the plate glass is a shocked autumnal moon. Frida's cheek is badly bruised. Otherwise, she's radiant with love. My mouth hangs open. What can I say, she says. I can't get enough of the man. Good night, I say, and forget about my car, and walk the 9 miles home in a daze. All day Wednesday, I prepare to tell Tim off, but I'm too scared. Plus, he could rightly say she's a consenting adult. Instead, I drop a few snots in his coffee cup and use my network access privileges to cancel his print jobs. He asks, can I work late, and in spite of myself, I fawningly say, sure. I hate him. I hate myself. Everybody else goes home. Big clouds roll in. I invoice like mad. Birds light on the dumpster and feed on substances caked on the lid. What a degraded cosmos. What a case of something starting out nice and going bad. Just after 7, I hear him shout, "You, darling, will rot in hell with the help of a swift push to the grave from me." At first, I think he's pillow-talking with Frida by phone. Then I look out the window and see the animal rights girl at the lip of our pit with a camcorder. Tim runs out the door with his blackjack unsheathed. What to do? Clearly, he means her harm. I follow him, leaving behind my loafers to minimize noise. I keep to the shadows and scurry in my socks from tiny berm to tiny berm. I heave in an unattractive manner. My heart rate's in the ionosphere. To my credit, I'm able to keep up with them. Meanwhile, she's struggling up the slope with her hair in sweet disarray, backlit by a moon the color of honey, camcorder on her head like some kind of Kenyan water jug. Harlot, Tim hisses, attempted defiler of my dream, and whips his blackjack down. Am I quick? I am so quick. I lunge up and take it on the wrist. My arm bone goes to mush and my head starts to spin, and I wrap Tim up in a hug the size of Tulsa. "Run," I gasp to the girl, and see in the moonlight the affluent white soles of our fleeing boat-type shoes. I hug hard. I tell him drop the jack, and to my surprise he does. Do I then release him? To my shame, no. So much sick rage is stored up in me, I never knew. And out it comes in one mondo squeeze, and something breaks, and he goes limp, and I lay him gently down in the dirt. I CPR like anything. I beg him to rise up and thrash me. I do a crazy little dance of grief, but it's no good. I've killed Tim. I sprint across 209 and ineffectually drag my bulk around Industrial Grotto, weeping and banging on locked corporate doors. United Knee Wraps having a gala. Their top brass are drunkenly lip-singing hits of the 50s en masse, and their foot soldiers are laughing like subservient fools so no one hears my frantic knocking. I prepare to heave a fake boulder through the plate glass, but then I stop. By now, Tim's beyond help. What do I gain by turning myself in? Did I or did I not save an innocent girl's life? Was he or was he not a cruel monster? And standing there outside the gala, I learned something vital about myself. When push comes to shove, I could care less about lofty ideals. It's me I love. It's me I want to protect. Me. I hustle back to the office for the burial gear. I roll Tim into the pit. I sprinkle on lime and cover him with dirt. I forge a letter in which he claims to be going to Mexico to clarify his relationship with God via silent meditation in a rugged desert setting. "My friends," I write through tears in his childish scrawl, "you slave away for minimal rewards. Freedom can be yours if you open yourself to the eternal. Good health and happiness to you all. I'm truly sorry for any offense I may have given. Also, I have thought long and hard on this and have decided to turn over the reins to Jeffrey, whom I have always wrongly maligned. I see now that he is a man of considerable gifts and ask you all to defer to him as you would to me." I leave the letter on Claude's chair and go out to sleep in my car. I dream of Tim wearing a white robe in a Mexican cantina. A mangy dog sits on his lap explaining the rules of the dead. No weeping, no pushing the other dead. Don't bore everyone with tales of how great you were. Tim smiles sweetly and rubs the dog behind the ears. He sees me and says no hard feelings and thanks for speeding him on to the realm of bliss. I wake with a start. The sun comes up, driving sparrows before it, turning the corporate reflective windows wild with orange. I roll out of my car and brush my teeth with my finger. My first day as a killer. I walk to the pit in the light of fresh day, hoping it was all a dream. But no. There's our scuffling footprints. There's the mound of fresh dirt under which lies Tim. I sit on a paint can in a patch of waving weeds and watch my colleagues arrive. I weep. I think sadly of the kindly bumbler I used to be, bleary-eyed in the morning, guiltless and looking forward to coffee. When I finally go in, everyone's gathered stunned around the microwave. "El Presidente," Claude says disgustedly. "Sorry?" I say. I make a big show of shaking my head in shock as I read and reread the note I wrote. I ask if this means I'm in charge. Claude says, with that kind of conceptual grasp, we're not exactly in for salad days. He asks Frida if she had an inkling. She says she always knew Tim had certain unplumbed depths, but this is ridiculous. Claude says he smells a rat. He says Tim never had a religious bone in his body and didn't speak a word of Spanish. My face gets red. "Thank God, Blamfin," that toady pipes up. I say, in terms of giving Jeffrey a chance, we should give Jeffrey a chance, inasmuch as Tim was a good manager but a kind of a mean guy, he says. "Well put," Claude says cynically, and I say this fatty knows something he's not telling. I praise Tim to the skies and admit I could never fill his shoes. I demean my organizational skills and leadership abilities but vow to work hard for the good of all. Then I humbly propose a vote. Do I assume leadership or not? Claude says he'll honor a quorum, and then, via show of hands, I achieve a nice one. I move my things into Tim's office. Because he'd always perceived me as a hefty milquetoast with no personal aspirations, he trusted me implicitly. So I'm able to access the corporate safe. I'm able to cater in prime rib and a trio of mustachioed violinists who stroll from cubicle to cubicle hoping for tips. Claude's outraged. Standing on his chair, he demands to know whatever happened to the profit motive. He says one can't run a corporation on good intentions and blatant naivete. He pleads that the staff fire me and appoint him CEO. Finally, Blanfin proposes I can him. Torsen from personnel seconds the motion. I shrug my shoulders and we vote and Claude's axed. He kicks the water cooler, he gives me the finger, but out he goes, leaving us to our chocolate mousse and cocktails. By nightfall, the party's kicked into high gear. I bring in jugglers and a comedian and drinks, drinks, drinks. My staff swears their undying loyalty. We make drunken toasts to my health and theirs. I tell them we'll kill no more. I tell them we'll come clean with the appropriate agencies and pay all relevant fines. Henceforth, we'll relocate the captured raccoons as we've always claimed to be doing. The company will be owned by us, the employees, who will come and go as we please. Daycare will be available on site. Frida brightens and sits on the arm of my chair. Muzak will give way to personal stereos in each cubicle. We will support righteous charities, take troubled children under our collective wing, enjoy afternoons off when the sun is high and the air sweet with the smell of mown grass, and, when one of us finally has to die, we will have the consolation of knowing that, aided by corporate largesse, our departed colleague has known his or her full measure of power, love, and beauty, and arm in arm we will all march to the graveyard singing sad hymns. Just then the cops break in, led by Claude, who's holding one of Tim's shoes. "If you went to Mexico," he shouts triumphantly, "wouldn't you take your Porsche? Would you be so stupid as to turn your life's work over to this tub of lard?" Things started to add up. I did some literal digging, and there I found my friend Tim with a crushed rib cage that broke my heart and a look of total surprise on his face. "My Timmy," Frida says, rising from my chair, "this disgusting pig killed my beautiful boy." They cuff me and lead me away. In court, I tell the truth. The animal rights girl comes out of the woodwork and corroborates my story. The judge says he appreciates my honesty and the fact that I saved a life. He wonders why, having saved a life, I didn't simply release him and reap the laurels of my courage. I tell him I lost control. I tell him a lifetime of scorn boiled over. He says he empathizes completely. He says he had a weight problem himself when a lad. Then he gives me 50 as opposed to life without parole. So now I know misery. I know the acute discomfort of a gray jail suit pieced together from two garments of normal size. I know the body odor of Vic, a Chicago kingpin who's claimed me for his own and compels me to wear a feminine hat with fruit on the brim for nightly interludes. Do my ex-colleagues write? No. Does Frida? Ha. Have I achieved serenity? No. Do I have a meaningful hobby that makes the days fly by like minutes? No. I have a wild desire to smell the ocean. I have a sense that God is unfair and preferentially punishes his weak, his dumb, his fat, his lazy. I believe he takes more pleasure in his perfect creatures and cheers them on like a brainless dad as they run roughshod over the rest of us. He gives us a need for love and no way to get any. He gives us a desire to be liked and personal attributes that make us utterly unlikable. Having placed his flawed and needy children in a world of exacting specifications, he deducts the difference between what we have and what we need from our hearts and our self-esteem and our mental health. This is how I feel. These things seem to me true. But what's there to do but behave with dignity? Keep a nice cell. Be polite but firm when Vic asks me to shimmy while wearing the hat. Join in at the top of my lungs when the geriatric murderer from Baton Rouge begins his nightly spiritual. Maybe the God we see, the God who calls the daily shots, is merely a sub-god. Maybe there's a God above this sub-god who's busy for a few God minutes with something else and will be right back. And when he gets back, we'll take the sub-god by the ear and say, "Now look. Look at that fat man. What did he ever do to you? Wasn't he humble enough? Didn't he endure enough abuse for 1,000 men? Weren't the simplest tasks hard? Didn't you sense him craving affection? Were you unaware that his days unraveled as one long bad dream?" And maybe as the sub-god slinks away, the true God will sweep me up in his arms, saying, "My sincere apologies, a mistake has been made. Accept a new birth as token of my esteem." And I will emerge again from between the legs of my mother, a slighter and more beautiful baby, destined for a different life, in which I am masterful, sleek as a deer, a winner.
The 400-pound CEO is in George Saunders' book of short stories, Civil War Land in Bad Decline.
I hope you enjoyed that entertaining, almost poetic story about Jeffrey, the 400-pound CEO, and now the plaything to Vic, the Chicago kingpin. I'm almost compelled to feel sorry for him, as pathetic as he is, but it's hard to warm up to someone that is that self-defeated. I wish he stood up for himself more, fought back a bit, and pursued some changes in his life to get him back to where he wanted to be. But alas, he was content in wallowing in self-pity. I just wanted to slap him about the head with a dead raccoon. Anyway, we now move along from one big man to perhaps the biggest man there has ever been. When I fall down, I've got more chins than Chinatown. In the second pod, we go back to the origins of the modern-day corporation, to a time where the profit motive rampaged unfettered, a time where governments were beginning to realise they had to rein in the amoral organisations that only seek to increase their power base and influence the marketplace by any means possible. This pod comes from a podcast called A History of Oil. It's a one-man show and is literally the human history of oil. The first show covers historical uses and understanding of oil, the first modern discoveries in the early 1800s, and the massive environmental chaos that followed those first discoveries. Each 15-minute episode moves chronologically through the people, places, and things that have shaped our completely oil-dependent current reality. Episode 4 of the History of Oil podcast follows the story of John D. Rockefeller, co-founder of the Standard Oil Company, which was the largest oil refiner in the world in the late 1800s, and whose conduct resulted in the creation of antitrust and monopoly legislation. How effective these laws have been is another matter. When Bang and I discussed this pod, the first thing we said was that it all just sounded like standard operating procedure for the Coles and Woolies type empires of today. In episode 10 of A History of Oil podcast, they say the fortune Rockefeller amassed was equal to 1/65th of the entire US economy, head and shoulders above anyone else that has ever lived. When you use the same yardstick to measure the wealth of today's richest men, like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, they don't even make the top 30. So, we present A History of Oil by Peter Duren, Episode 4, The Anaconda.
Is A History of Oil, Episode 4, The Anaconda. Before we get started, some listeners have asked to know a bit more about the History of Oil podcast. If you have questions or would like to know more, feel free to stop by historyofoil.typepad.com to comment on episodes or find out more about the people and places discussed in the episode. As for the History of Oil podcast, well, like so many of my history brethren, our day jobs tend to be a little different from our passions. As for my own day job, I'm luckier than most since I specialize as an energy analyst. And no, there's no financing from big oil or a nefarious plot to get listeners to burn more hydrocarbons. This is also why we had an extended break after our pilot episodes. Thanks to everyone for their excellent feedback on the history of oil. When you embark on something like this, it's good to know that people are interested. But if so many people were interested, we wanted to make sure that the sound quality was up to snuff. We went back and improved some of the sound from the earlier pilot episodes, and you might notice a slight improvement now. As for the History of Oil podcast, we'll continue to dive deeper into this strange substance that no one wants to touch, smell, or taste, but everyone wants to control. As we'll see going forward, this drive will change the policies of state. It will alter the outcome of modern conflict and keep us neck deep in the twists and schemes of some pretty colorful characters. One of the most significant of these characters was John D. Rockefeller. Last time on A History of Oil, this Whole Foods salesman in Cleveland, Ohio, had discovered just how much money could be made in the oil business. But Rockefeller was no ordinary grocer. For good or bad, this decision to get into the refining industry would have a permanent impact, not only on the oil business, but on the limits of what we consider legal and illegal in the world of modern business. Since we started A History of Oil, we've sketched out the contours of the early industry. In this episode, we're going to complete that sketch with the introduction of Rockefeller and Standard Oil, a monster of a company that will soon inspire equal parts fear, disgust, and, depending on who you ask, a little bit of admiration. The other reason for our sketch is because the basic structure of the oil business will remain essentially unchanged well into the 21st century. Make no mistake, a lot will change in the oil industry over the next 150 years. The sources of oil, the methods for refining it, techniques for distributing it, and the ways in which most people use it, all of these will definitely change as we go forward. But from the early wellheads in Oil Creek to the end consumers in the marketplace, the bones, veins, and muscles of the modern industry are now clearly recognizable in the early days of the Pennsylvania boom. And that, to say the least, was part of Rockefeller's problem. Oil fever had now taken the whole of the United States. There were songs about it, books about it, and countless rags-to-riches stories about it. Even lawmakers in Washington were infected. In fact, U.S. Representative James Garfield, soon to be President Garfield, proclaimed at the time that he and a number of others in Congress are in the oil business, for you must know that the fever has assailed Congress in no mild form. It seemed that everyone now had a stake in oil, and that extended all the way to Rockefeller's grocery in Cleveland, Ohio. By 1859, a 23-year-old John D. Rockefeller had settled into the wholesale grocery business. From a very early age, Rockefeller had already demonstrated a knack for numbers and for money, so much so that he kept a private ledger to meticulously record every receipt, expenditure, and donation he made throughout the day. As a result, on any given evening for the entirety of his life, Rockefeller would know to the penny how much he was worth. But this wasn't unvarnished greed, not in the kind that was running so rampant in the oil fields of Pennsylvania. For Rockefeller, money was something different. From the time he was a young adolescent and turned his first profit selling turkeys to his mother, then reinvesting those profits by loaning out the turkey proceeds at interest to local farmers, Rockefeller had discovered that money could beget money. Dollars could spawn new dollars. You just had to manage them well. This was a powerful lesson for young Rockefeller, one which later in life he would reflect upon. "It was a good thing to let money be my servant," he recalled, "and not to make myself a slave to it." It was this attitude which Rockefeller brought to the grocery business. He sold wheat, salt, and pork, and when the deluge of Pennsylvania oil hit the U.S. home lighting market, Rockefeller and his partners, including one Maurice Clark, bought and sold that too. But like so many commercial partnerships, this one eventually split over the pace of expansion into a new line of business. In this case, the oil business. Clark was cautious. Rockefeller wanted to move fast. Their positions were intractable. And so, in 1865, the very same year that the Civil War staggered to a bloody close, Rockefeller and Clark agreed to hold a private auction. The loser would get the cash. The winner would get the company. Bidding started at $500. The bidding continued past 10, 20, and 50,000. Finally, Clark offered $72,000. Rockefeller topped him with $72,500. "I'll go no higher, John," Clark said. And with that, at the age of 25, the company belonged to Rockefeller. The company, whose main successors would eventually be worth more than $500 billion in combined market value, was purchased for roughly $1 million in today's money. And thanks to a new rail line and transportation link stretching both east and west, Cleveland was in a position to compete with other cities in America as a destination point for all of the oil gushing out of the Pennsylvania hills. At the time, most consumers purchased home lighting oil from their grocer, just as they did the other goods supplied by Rockefeller. But unlike most of the 29 other refineries operating in and around Cleveland, Rockefeller plowed much of the revenue from his back into the business. This ensured that Rockefeller's refinery had enough money to weather the ups and downs of the volatile oil market. Within a year, Rockefeller controlled the largest refinery in Cleveland. Within 2 years, he built a second, and by the end of the 1860s, he owned one of the largest, if not the largest, in the country. Controlling quality and costs were his primary concerns. As he would later write, "All sorts of people were in the refining business, the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker." But with so many new entrants into the marketplace, consumers never quite knew what they were getting when they filled a lamp with oil to light their homes. As you can imagine, butchers and bakers don't always make the best oil refiners, and if the end product was not produced correctly, it would light up like gasoline and most likely kill the person holding the match. Rockefeller's edge was quality, reliable quality. By insisting on it, consumers would know that the kerosene he produced was consistent, and they wouldn't have to risk their lives just to light a room. Yet even more than quality, Rockefeller was a hawk for controlling costs and storing up cash on his balance sheet. Having a lot of money in reserve meant that he didn't need to rely on banks to finance his day-to-day operations. It also meant that he could integrate various components of the business. His company grew its own timber for barrels, owned its own rail cars to move goods to market, and held a slew of warehouses and river barges to keep it close to consumers. In 1869, Henry Flagler joined Rockefeller's burgeoning company. Flagler was an entrepreneur cut from the same cloth. He had already made a fast fortune in the whiskey business, but gave that up for moral reasons. Unfortunately, Flagler's follow-up performance in the salt business was a flop, and he was now back to square one with little to show for his effort. Rockefeller took an immediate liking to Flagler, a man so full of vim and push, he would say. And as the oil business plunged into yet another price collapse at the end of the 1860s, Flagler was precisely the kind of man that Rockefeller needed, not only to weather the storm, but to profit from it. 10 years earlier, the oil industry was crippled by a lack of refining capacity. Now, the tables had turned. There was too much, and refiners were falling all over themselves to sell their product at any price they could get. Prices reached such a low that many were taking a loss on every barrel produced. In the good times, the butchers and bakers of the world could make money in oil, but in this new race to the bottom, most of Rockefeller's competition was flirting with bankruptcy. On the other hand, the cash-rich balance sheet which Rockefeller and Flagler had built up during the good years was now a fortress. And not unlike the financial crisis of our own time, Flagler and Rockefeller watched as the price of companies hit mind-boggling, ridiculous lows. It was a buyer's market, if you had enough money to buy. Rockefeller and Flagler had enough to survive the choppy water, but they'd need a lot more if they were going to cut off large chunks of the refining industry and consolidate it under a single company, their company. Going to the banks or even to Wall Street meant that Rockefeller would have to surrender too much control. So they raised private money. On January 10, 1870, Rockefeller and Flagler transformed their relationship into a joint stock company, and Standard Oil was born. So here we have yet another company. Didn't we make a big deal about Bissell's Seneca Oil Company a few episodes back? Well, sure we did. And if Bissell was a trailblazer in drilling for oil, John D. Rockefeller was a trailblazer in doing just about everything you could possibly get away with because no one had yet made laws to make it illegal. And even when the laws were pretty clear, Standard bent and twisted them to the point of breaking. So for anyone inside Standard Oil, Flagler was a man of vim and push. But for everyone on the outside, he was a bold, unscrupulous self-seeker who did whatever was necessary for success. Enter the Southern Improvement Company. As it turns out, Rockefeller and company weren't the only ones losing sleep over the endless race to the bottom in prices. It was bad for everyone's business, and it was especially bad for railroad owners. As it happened, the president of the Pennsylvania Railroad hit upon an idea to solve this problem with prices. He could make the freight business profitable again if all of the other railroads agreed to a secret price-fixing scheme. Under the plan, all of the railroad companies would raise prices across the board. They'd use the extra cash they'd made to discount the price they charged to special VIP customers. Customers like Standard Oil, who moved a lot of product and kept the trains profitable. Discounts were nice, but to sweeten the deal, the railroads made an offer that Standard Oil couldn't refuse. They'd charge competing oil companies more money and give Standard a cut of all the extra fees. It was perfect, and if you've ever wondered why market collusion and secret price-fixing schemes are illegal, you can point to the Southern Improvement Company, the front organization for the whole idea. Nobody had ever heard of it, but suddenly, the Southern Improvement Company was everywhere. For struggling refiners who were not yet part of the Standard Oil family, the abrupt rise in shipping costs hurt almost as much as the sustained decline in oil prices. Many were eager to sell when the courteous, respectful men from Standard dropped by to talk about the terrible headaches of running a refinery. You know, Standard would be willing to purchase your company, and for a good price. That was the soft sell. If a business owner refused, they got the hard version. At first, Standard would make them feel sick by selectively lowering prices in their specific market. If that didn't work, they'd muscle shop owners not to stock competing products. Some customers would only buy Standard's brand of kerosene. And if you wanted to buy from us, Standard would say, you can't sell anyone else's product. At one point, Standard even created an artificial shortage in oil barrels, since many competitors couldn't move oil without a barrel. Sometimes it was hard to know if you were even dealing with Standard Oil, thanks to the company's web of fronts and secret subsidiaries. As a producer, you might scratch your head over how a competing family business could sell their product at a given price and still survive. It was impossible, but that didn't stop them from pricing you out of the market. Independent refiners weren't the only ones who were confused. When a railroad clerk accidentally billed one refiner at the surprisingly low rate usually afforded to the VIPs and the Southern Improvement Company, the payback scheme started to unravel. Once the secret was out, the backlash was harsh. It was no coincidence. Standard Oil was really trying to destroy them. Across Pennsylvania's oil regions, local producers gathered in the streets and talked loudly of conspiracy. As a 14-year-old daughter of one oil man would write later in life, "For weeks, the whole body of oil men abandoned regular business and surged from town to town, intent on destroying the monster, the 40 thieves, and the great anaconda." That witness was a young woman named Ida Tarbell. The outrage and injustice she witnessed made an indelible impression on her mind, an impression about greed and dirty tricks, and most of all, about Standard Oil. It would be years before Rockefeller would even hear her name, but she knew his, and the young woman from oildom was about to make it her life's work to bring down Rockefeller's unstoppable anaconda. This is A History of Oil.
Yeah, my anaconda don't want none unless it can corner the market and squeeze the life out of the competition. We have included links to Peter Duren's website in the show notes and advise anyone interested to go and check it out. He's collected some fantastic historical photos on the Wild West early days of oil. He's got gushers and bubblers and all sorts of crazy stuff. Check it out. It's well worth a look. In the next pod, we look at the dodgy practices of the pharmaceutical industry. Dodgy practices that make it difficult for doctors to compare existing drugs against new ones in treating their patients. They do this by fraudulently manipulating drug trial data. This is taken from a TED Talk seminar filmed in July 2011 by Dr. Ben Goldacre, entitled "Battling Bad Science." He provides an entertaining and insightful presentation on this topic and gives us an inside look at the issues facing doctors today in prescribing us the best treatments for our ailments. Links in the show notes.
TED Talks are recorded live at the TED Conference. This episode features doctor and debunker Ben Goldacre. This talk contains powerful visuals. Download the video at TED.com. Here's Ben Goldacre.
So I'm a doctor, but I kind of slipped sideways into research, and now I'm an epidemiologist. And nobody really knows what epidemiology is. Epidemiology is the science of how we know in the real world if something is good for you or bad for you. And it's best understood, through example, as the science of those crazy, wacky newspaper headlines. And these are just some of the examples. These are from the Daily Mail. Every country in the world has a newspaper like this. It has this kind of bizarre, ongoing philosophical project of dividing all the inanimate objects in the world, really, into the ones that either cause or prevent cancer. So here are some of the things they've said cause cancer recently: divorce, Wi-Fi, toiletries, and coffee. Here are some of the things they say prevent cancer: crust, red pepper, licorice, and coffee. So already you can see there are contradictions here. Coffee both causes and prevents cancer. And as you start to read on, you can see that maybe there's some kind of political valence behind some of this. So for women, housework prevents breast cancer, but for men, shopping could make you impotent. So we know that we need to start unpicking the science behind this. And what I hope to show is that unpicking dodgy claims, unpicking the evidence behind dodgy claims, isn't a kind of nasty carping activity. It's socially useful, but it's also a kind of an extremely valuable explanatory tool, because real science is all about critically appraising the evidence for somebody else's position. That's what happens in academic journals. That's what happens at academic conferences. The Q&A session after a postdoc presents data is often a bloodbath, and nobody minds that. We actively welcome it. It's like a kind of consenting intellectual S&M activity. So what I'm going to show you is all of the main themes, all of the main features of my discipline, evidence-based medicine. And I will talk you through all of these and demonstrate how they work, exclusively using examples of people getting stuff wrong. So we'll start with the absolute weakest form of evidence known to man, and that is authority. In science, we don't care how many letters you have after your name. In science, we want to know what your reasons are for believing something. How do you know that something is good for us or bad for us? But we're also unimpressed by authority because it's so easy to contrive. This is somebody called Dr. Gillian McKeith, PhD, or to give her full medical title, Gillian McKeith. Again, every country has somebody like this. She is our TV diet guru. She has massive kind of five series of primetime television giving out very lavish and exotic health advice. She, it turns out, has a non-accredited correspondence course, PhD, from somewhere in America. She also boasts that she's a certified professional member of the American Association of Nutritional Consultants, which sounds very glamorous and exciting. You get a certificate and everything. This one belongs to my dead cat, Hetty. She was a horrible cat. You just go to the website, fill out the form, give them $60, and it arrives in the post. Now, that's not the only reason that we think this person is an idiot. She also goes on and says things like, you should eat lots of dark green leaves because they contain lots of chlorophyll and that will really oxygenate your blood. And anybody who's done school biology remembers that chlorophyll in chloroplasts only makes oxygen in sunlight, and it's quite dark in your bowels after you've eaten spinach. Next, we need proper science, proper evidence. So, red wine could help prevent breast cancer. This is a headline from the Daily Telegraph in the UK. A glass of red wine a day could help prevent breast cancer. So you go and find this paper, and what you find is, it is a real piece of science. It's a description of the changes in the behaviour of one enzyme when you drip a chemical extracted from some red grape skin onto some cancer cells in a dish on a bench in a laboratory somewhere. And that's a really useful thing to describe in a scientific paper. But on the question of your own personal risk of getting breast cancer if you drink red wine, it tells you absolutely bugger all, okay? Actually, it turns out that your risk of breast cancer actually increases slightly with every amount of alcohol that you drink. So, what we want is studies in real human people. And here's another example. This is from Britain's leading diet nutritionist in the Daily Mirror, which is our second biggest selling newspaper. An Australian study in 2001 found that olive oil in combination with fruits, vegetables and pulses offers measurable protection against skin wrinkling. So then they give the advice, if you eat olive oil and vegetables, you'll have fewer skin wrinkles. And they very helpfully tell you how to find the paper. So you go and find the paper. And what you find is an observational study, right? Obviously, nobody has ever been able to go back to like 1930, get all of the people born in one maternity unit and half of them eat lots of fruit and veg and olive oil, and then half of them eat McDonald's, and then we see how many wrinkles you've got later. You have to take a snapshot of how people are now. And what you find is, of course, people who eat fruit and veg and olive oil have fewer skin wrinkles. But that's because people who eat fruit and veg and olive oil, they're freaks, okay? They're not normal. They're like you. They come to events like this, right? They are posh, they're wealthy, they're less likely to have outdoor jobs, they're less likely to do manual labour, they have better social support, they're less likely to smoke. So for a whole host of fascinating interlocking social, political and cultural reasons, they are less likely to have skin wrinkles. That doesn't mean that it's the vegetables or the olive oil. So, ideally what you want to do is a trial, and everybody thinks they're very familiar with the idea of a trial. Trials are very old. The first trial was in the Bible, Daniel 1:12. It's very straightforward. You take a bunch of people, you split them in half, you treat one group one way, you treat the other group the other way, and then a little while later you follow them up and see what happened to each of them. So I'm going to tell you about one trial, which is probably the most well-reported trial in the UK news media over the past decade. And this is a trial of fish oil pills. And the claim was fish oil pills improve school performance and behaviour in mainstream children. And they said, we've done a trial. All the previous trials were positive, and we know this one's going to be too. That should always ring alarm bells, right? Because if you already know the answer to your trial, you shouldn't be doing one. Either you've rigged it by design, or you've got enough data so there's no need to randomise people anymore. So this is what they were going to do in their trial. They were taking 3,000 children. They were going to give them all these huge fish oil pills, six of them a day. And then a year later, they were going to measure their school exam performance and compare their exam performance against what they predicted their exam performance would have been if they hadn't had the pills. Now, can anybody spot a flaw in this design? And no professors of clinical trial methodology are allowed to answer this question. So there's no control. Okay, there's no control group, but that sounds really techie, right? That sounds really... No, that's a technical term. The kids got the pills, and then their performance improved. What else could it possibly be if it wasn't the pills? They got older, okay, we all develop over time. And of course, also, there's the placebo effect. The placebo effect is one of the most fascinating things in the whole of medicine. It's not just about taking a pill and your performance and your pain getting better. It's about our beliefs and expectations. It's about the cultural meaning of a treatment. And this has been demonstrated in a whole raft of fascinating studies comparing one kind of placebo against another. So we know, for example, that two sugar pills a day are a more effective treatment for getting rid of gastric ulcers than one sugar pill a day. Two sugar pills a day beats one sugar pill a day. And that's an outrageous and ridiculous finding, but it's true. We know from three different studies on three different types of pain that a salt water injection is a more effective treatment for pain than taking a sugar pill, taking a dummy pill that has no medicine in it. Not because the injection or the pill do anything physically to the body, but because an injection feels like a much more dramatic intervention. So we know that our beliefs and expectations can be manipulated, which is why we do trials where we control against a placebo, where one half of the people get the real treatment and the other half get placebo. But that's not enough. What I've just shown you are examples of the very simple and straightforward ways that journalists and food supplement pill peddlers and naturopaths can distort evidence for their own purposes. What I find really fascinating is that the pharmaceutical industry use exactly the same kinds of tricks and devices, but slightly more sophisticated versions of them, in order to distort the evidence that they give to doctors and patients and which we use to make vitally important decisions. So, firstly, trials against placebo. Everybody thinks they know that a trial should be a comparison of your new drug against placebo. But actually, in a lot of situations, that's wrong, because often we already have a very good treatment that is currently available. So we don't want to know that your alternative new treatment is better than nothing. We want to know that it's better than the best currently available treatment that we have. And yet, repeatedly, you consistently see people doing trials still against placebo, and you can get licensed to bring your drug to market with only data showing that it's better than nothing, which is useless for a doctor like me trying to make a decision. But that's not the only way that you can rig your data. You can also rig your data by making the thing that you compare your new drug against really rubbish. You can give the competing drug in too low a dose so that people aren't properly treated. You can give the competing drug in too high a dose so that people get side effects. And this is exactly what happened with antipsychotic medication for schizophrenia. 20 years ago, a new generation of antipsychotic drugs were brought in, and the promise was that they would have fewer side effects. So people set about doing trials of these new drugs against the old drugs, but they gave the old drugs in ridiculously high doses, 20 milligrams a day of haloperidol. And it's a foregone conclusion if you give a drug at that higher dose that it will have more side effects and that your new drug will look better. 10 years ago, history repeated itself, interestingly, when risperidone, which was the first of the new generation antipsychotic drugs, came off copyright, so anybody could make copies. Everybody wanted to show that their drug was better than risperidone, so you see a bunch of trials comparing new antipsychotic drugs against risperidone at 8 milligrams a day. Again, not an insane dose, not an illegal dose, but very much at the high end of normal, and so you're bound to make your new drug look better. And so it's no surprise that overall, industry-funded trials are four times more likely to give a positive result than independently sponsored trials. But, and it's a big but, it turns out, when you look at the methods used by industry-funded trials, that they're actually better than independently sponsored trials. And yet, they always manage to get the result that they want. So how does this work? How can we explain this strange phenomenon? Well, it turns out that what happens is the negative data goes missing in action. It's withheld from doctors and patients. And this is the most important aspect of the whole story. It's at the top of the pyramid of evidence. We need to have all of the data on a particular treatment to know whether or not it really is effective. And there are two different ways that you can spot whether some data has gone missing in action. You can use statistics or you can use stories. I personally prefer statistics, so that's what I'm going to do first. This is something called a funnel plot. And a funnel plot is a very clever way of spotting if small negative trials have disappeared, have gone missing in action. So this is a graph of all of the trials that have been done on a particular treatment, and as you go up towards the top of the graph, what you see is each dot is a trial, and as you go up to the top, those are the bigger trials, so they've got less error in them, so they're less likely to be randomly false positives, randomly false negatives, so they all cluster together. The big trials are closer to the true answer. Then, as you go further down at the bottom, what you can see is over on this side, spurious false negatives, and over on this side, the spurious false positives. If there is publication bias, if small negative trials have gone missing in action, you can see it on one of these graphs. So you can see here that the small negative trials that should be on the bottom left have disappeared. This is a graph demonstrating the presence of publication bias in studies of publication bias, and I think that's the funniest epidemiology joke that you will ever hear. That's how you can prove it statistically. But what about stories? Well, they're heinous. They really are. This is a drug called reboxetine, and this is a drug which I myself have prescribed to patients. And I'm a very nerdy doctor. I hope I go out of my way to try and read and understand all the literature. I read the trials on this. They were all positive. They were all well conducted. I found no flaw. Unfortunately, it turned out that many of these trials were withheld. In fact, 76% of all of the trials that were done on this drug were withheld from doctors and patients. Now, if you think about it, if I toss a coin 100 times and I'm allowed to withhold from you the answers half the times, then I can convince you that I have a coin with two heads, okay? If we remove half of the data, we can never know what the true effect size of these medicines is. And this is not an isolated story. Around half of all of the trial data on antidepressants has been withheld, but it goes way beyond that. The Nordic Cochrane Group were trying to get hold of the data on that to bring it all together. The Cochrane Groups are an international non-profit collaboration that produce systematic reviews of all of the data that has ever been shown, and they need to have access to all of the trial data. But the companies withheld that data from them. And so did the European Medicines Agency for 3 years. This is a problem that is currently lacking a solution. And to show how big it goes, this is a drug called Tamiflu, which governments around the world have spent billions and billions of dollars on. And they spent that money on the promise that this is a drug which will reduce the rate of complications with flu. We already have the data showing that it reduces the duration of your flu by a few hours, but I don't really care about that. Governments don't care about that. I'm very sorry if you have the flu. I know it's horrible, but we're not going to spend billions of dollars trying to reduce the duration of your flu symptoms by half a day. We prescribe these drugs, we stockpile them for emergencies on the understanding they will reduce the number of complications, which means pneumonia and which means death. The infectious diseases Cochrane Group, which are based in Italy, have been trying to get the full data in a usable form out of the drug company so that they can make a full decision about whether this drug is effective or not, and they've not been able to get that information. This is undoubtedly the single biggest ethical problem facing medicine today. We cannot make decisions in the absence of all of the information. So it's a little bit difficult from there to spin in some kind of positive conclusion. But I would say this. I think that sunlight is the best disinfectant. All of these things are happening in plain sight, and they're all protected by a kind of force field of tediousness. And I think with all of the problems in science, one of the best things that we can do is to lift up the lid, finger around at the mechanics, and peer in. Thank you very much.
That was Ben Goldacre, recorded at TED 2011 in Long Beach, California, March 2011. For more information on TED, visit TED.com.
I find it disturbing that drug companies can be so devious and incognizant of their responsibility in ensuring the safety of anyone who uses their drugs. I mean, the drugs we take to get better can seriously impact how we live and can have seriously adverse effects. It just goes to show the depth of their greed that they need to see a payout, even if it means endangering people's lives with horrible side effects. I don't want to diminish the great work that has been done in the creation of drugs, but it only takes a small amount of carelessness and disregard to report all findings, especially negative ones, to direly affect somebody. I think this is a situation where full disclosure of information needs to be mandatory. Let us move on. And we do so onto a swampland of greyness, a very murky place indeed. This final pod today is a tale of revenge and getting back at the African scammers. How do you stop the scammers? Well, you give them a dose of their own medicine. You make them feel as helpless as they make those that they scam feel. Is it fair or right, given the great cultural divide? Listen and decide. From This American Life, number 363, Enforcers, Act 1, Hanging in Chad. Links in the show notes.
Quine, hanging in Chad. Like everybody else who has email, I've gotten those messages where they say that there is $8 million sitting in a bank in Nigeria and the money is just sitting there doing nothing. And somebody needs help getting that money out of the country. But until recently, when somebody explained it to me, I never really stopped to think about how this scam actually works. If you reply to those emails after some back and forth, they let you know there's a processing fee that you're going to need to pay for the courier or the insurance or whatever. And after you pay that, of course, they don't deliver the money. There'll be some problem, some bank official who needs to be bribed or some new fee. And they're very sorry. They're sure if you just do this one more thing, you'll get your money. And so you pay that, and then on and on it goes. They string you along for as long as they can. In 2007, Americans reported losing $15 million to this particular email scam. And the real number may be more like $100 million, according to the federal government's Internet Crime Complaint Center, which says that the average loss to each victim is about $2,000. Though, and here's the reason why I'm bringing all this up, it is rare for anybody to be arrested for this. The thieves are hard to catch because it turns out they really are overseas in places that American law enforcement has a hard time reaching. Lots of them are actually in Nigeria. So many that one nickname for this kind of con is to call it a 419 scam. 419 is the part of the Nigerian criminal code that deals with fraud. So, into this breach, onto this lawless frontier, where traditional police work has failed, have stepped the vigilantes. Internet vigilantes. The proud, the brave.
I live in the Midwest. I'm a 42-year-old software engineer. I've got four children.
I will identify this man and his friends only with their nom de guerre. His is Yeah Whatever. And he ran the vigilante action I'm going to tell you about today, alongside two of his friends, JoJo, somewhere below the Mason-Dixon line.
I'm early 20s, single. I am an engineer.
And there's Professor So-and-So. Out in a western state.
I'm 31 years old, and I have a 4-year-old daughter.
Three of these guys met on the discussion boards of a website called 419eater.com. That 419 in the name, yes, refers to the Nigerian criminal code. This is a website where internet vigilantes like themselves compare stories and share victories and swap trade secrets on how to get the email scammers. And this spring and summer, these three guys ran an operation against the scammers that not only exceeded all expectations and became kind of an internet sensation in their community, scoring more page views than anything comparable. But it also raised some interesting questions about whether these internet vigilantes, these self-appointed enforcers, go too far. Chances are you may have heard of guys who do this. They've been around for a while. They call themselves baiters or scam baiters because they bait the con men into doing all kinds of ridiculous things. They convince them to get funny tattoos or build pyramids out of sandbags. Or pose for embarrassing photos. On YouTube, you can watch some West African email scammers perform on video an old Monty Python sketch about a dead parrot. They had been told over email that they could get a pile of money, a scholarship grant, if it were any good.
I wish to complain about this parrot that I bought not half an hour ago from this very shop. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. What's wrong with it? I will tell you what's wrong with it. Is that no.
If you're wondering what good this does anybody, the idea, besides amusing yourself and your friends on the discussion boards and administering some karmic justice, is to waste the con men's time so they have fewer hours in the day to scam people. And the bait that I'm going to tell you about today wasted an astonishing amount of the con men's time, maybe more than any bait ever. It began when somebody on the discussion board got a hold of a scam email from a Nigerian whose name was supposedly Adamu. He wrote to this Adamu, pretending to be an official from a missionary church, which is a time-tested bait.
Well, the way it typically worked was one of these scammers would contact the church. We would write back and say, well, unless you're a member of the church, we really can't get involved in any financial transactions with you. So if you want to become a member, great. Otherwise, good luck with your transaction. Then they decide that they want the money really bad. They join the church, and we just play them from there.
The idea, Yeah Whatever says, is to get the scammer off of his script for what's going to happen and onto theirs, which worked with this guy Adamu.
But we got him totally in a different direction. We offered him grant money to start a church in Nigeria.
And how much did you offer him?
$200,000.
But if Adamu wanted to get the $200,000, they told him, he would have to take a trip, a long trip, from Lagos, Nigeria, to a completely different country, Chad. When baiters send Kaman on this kind of trip, they refer to it as a safari. It's wild goose chase, basically. Though, of course, that's not what they told Adamu. They invented an entire cast of made-up characters who started emailing and occasionally telephoning Adamu. All of them were part of this church that they had invented. There was a Reverend Benjamin who informed Adamu that if Adamu could somehow make it to Chad, there was a missionary named Hamden there and a translator named Eric who would meet him and drive him to where he would get the $200,000. Here's Jojo.
We basically said what you need to do is you need to get a one-way ticket from Nigeria to N'Djamena, Chad, which is right on the border of Nigeria. It's about 800 or 900 miles away. You don't need to worry about clothes or food because once you get there, everything's going to be provided for you. And we're going to send our missionary, Hamden, we're going to send him to pick you up in N'Djamena, and you're going to leave with the $200,000. You know, everything's going to be taken care of once you get to N'Djamena.
To help the church representatives recognize Adamu in the town square in N'Djamena, they ask Adamu to wear a white robe and a bright pink sash and hold a sign with a slightly obscene message about Muhammad, this in the middle of a Muslim country. Now, to give you a sense of what Chad is like, somebody posts on the Scambaiter discussion board the official travel advisory for Chad that was issued by the Canadian government. It describes the entire country as unstable. Possible clashes between rebels and government troops, it says, civil unrest and violent incidents can occur at all times, including in N'Djamena, Adamu's first stop. There are live minefields, there are roaming armed militias, there are bandits.
Yeah, it's very dangerous.
And then are you trying to get him hurt or are you just trying to scare him?
No, we're not trying to get him hurt.
We're not trying to get him hurt, but it's really just isolating him. What we wanted to do was just isolate him, get him out there, cut off from any ability to communicate with potential real-life victims, and keep him there as long as we could.
And on April 1st, they start getting emails from Adamu saying that he has arrived in Chad, but there is nobody there to meet him. They email back, explaining that Hamden's car broke down on the road halfway between N'Djamena and a town called Abeche, and that's why Hamden isn't there to pick him up. And right away, Adamu writes back to them saying his situation is pretty rough. He's traveling, by the way, with a man who he identifies as his brother, who may or may not be his real brother.
This is an excerpt from something on April 3rd. Please, I am not okay here since 4 days now I am stranded in N'Djamena. The worst is I don't have single money with me here. Please. it's hard to read these without even laughing. Please, for God's sake, tell Hamden to come today or latest tomorrow. No food for me, no water to drink because of the language problem. No English, only Arabic language and Hausa. That is why I come with my brother that can speak Hausa but not Arabic. I am very, very hungry.
And he writes in another email around the same time, you call me as soon as you reach. Please, no food, no water since 4 days now. What do you think's really happening? Do you really believe that he has no food and no water?
No.
Nope.
No. I mean, he's got money to check the internet.
Right.
You know, yeah. What kind of priorities are those? These guys are used to telling lies for a living. I don't disagree that it probably is pretty bad there, but, you know, he's not as hungry as he claims.
For the next few weeks, the truth of Adamu's situation, as best as they can figure, is this. He's living at the bus station, sleeping outside, still in the same clothes he arrived in. He has a little money to email them from the internet cafe, but very soon his cell phone dies. This is pretty much exactly the kind of misery that the baiters had hoped to inflict in the first place. And on the discussion boards with their peers, there's a lot of high-fiving and celebration. Ha ha ha, I love this, somebody writes. I almost feel sorry for him. But not really. And at this point, the baiters move to phase two of their plan. N'Djamena is bad, but now they do everything they can to convince Adamu to come to Abeche, 400 miles further from home, and 400 miles closer to a part of the world you've probably heard of, Darfur, which is just on the other side of the border between Chad and Sudan. Phase two will take him to the town of Abeche, which is still in Chad, but less than 100 miles from the border. Conditions there are much more dangerous than in N'Djamena. If he hits a betche, Professor So-and-so writes on the discussion board, he is more screwed than he can even imagine. To lure him there, they send him fake receipts for Western Union money transfers that he can only pick up at the Western Union office in Abeche. They try to convince him to join Hamden, whose car is supposedly still stuck halfway to Abeche. And Yeah Whatever writes an email, pretending to be Eric, the church's translator, talking about how great it is all going to be once he gets to Abeche. If Yeah Whatever and his buddies sound surprisingly gleeful as they talk about this, well, we'll get to that.
Brother Adamu, you'll be happy to know that Abeche is a quiet, very small town, just a couple hundred people. Unlike in N'Djamena, everything in Abeche is easy to find, and everyone there is far more friendly. Really not true, but anyway. We live in a building exactly 20 meters to the west of the UN office. It's easy to find that building. It is the only building in the center of town that has satellite dishes all over it. We don't really know if there is such a building, but... it sounded nice. Anyhow, everyone knows us in Abeche. All you need to do is ask for Hamdan or me. Everyone knows us. I look forward to finally meeting you and your brother. This has taken way too long already, and I'm sure that both of you and your brother are looking forward to the plane ride back home.
So you're trying to get into Abeche, and at one point you actually email him saying, okay, the guy's coming today with the car, and then he doesn't answer that email fast enough, and then you email him again saying, where were you? We sent the guy with the car just to...
We actually had the driver call him. We asked...
You had him call him.
Yeah, another baiter. I asked him if he would make the call. So he had a voice modulation software and software that he could add sounds, so he put a sound of like a busy street on. And called as the driver, freaking out on him about not being able to find him and waiting 2 hours.
Wait a minute. I've been trying to call this number for 2 hours. I went there to pick you up. Ain't nobody there. Damn it, I'm crotchety. You know what? He gave me some money to give to you. I'm on my way back now. I'm leaving.
He told him he was keeping the money, and then we had to follow up and let him know exactly what happened. He missed the driver.
So that's just to make him feel as bad as possible, it seems.
It was his fault.
Oh, right.
Well, just to make it his fault. You know, essentially.
That's one thing we like to do is it's never any of our fault. It's always their fault, you know. It's not our fault. It's Western Union's fault. It's not our fault, you know, that you didn't get the email. The driver was there. You know, so we create this illusion that we are being so very compliant with everything they're asking for.
This technique is exactly what the scammers do themselves. They tell you that they are doing everything possible to help you get your money. But there's always one more problem that prevents you from getting the big payout. One more hoop to go through. The scam baiters are like cops, taking the same tactics as the criminals. Don't they recognize the fact that you're using the same technique on them that they use on the people who they're scamming?
It baffles us.
You would think they would, but they don't.
You would think so.
Yeah, well, the obvious difference with us is we're not asking for money. We're just asking them to travel from one place to another. So maybe that's enough for them not to see it. It seems to work time and time again.
And then once you get them isolated, once you get them, you know, somewhere like in N'Djamena, well, they really don't have an option but to believe. You know, it's the same mentality that some of these victims have. They've sent so much, they've gone this far that they can't really turn back at this point.
And I've read on your discussion board, people talk about this victim mentality. Once you've given up some money or some time, to actually believe that it's a scam, it's just too horrible to think about. And it's just easier to think, oh, this is going to work out.
Right. And I think the same thing holds true with them.
The guys managed to keep Adamu and his brother waiting in N'Djamena for 21 days, which is an incredibly long time for one of these scam bait safaris. Usually they just ask a day or two. And they are nowhere near finished. They do manage to convince Adamu to go to Abeche, where conditions, as predicted, are much, much worse. Adamu gets there by telling a driver that he will pay the driver $500 when they arrive in Abeche. All they'll have to do is go to the Western Union office in Abeche, where supposedly money is waiting for them, sent by the church. Though, of course, when they show up, something is wrong with the paperwork at Western Union. They have no money to give the driver, who gets angry. Adamu writes increasingly desperate emails to his friends in the fake church. Each one begins with a pleading reminder that they are at the Cyber Cafe on Hospital Road, waiting for the church officials to finally arrive and rescue them.
My life is in great danger here because of the driver that has brought us here. Have not been pay, and he is treating our life.
Threatening, I guess.
These are being read as written, so.
Yeah.
Now there is tension. There is tension all over my body because of the driver threatening me of his money. Save me from the driver hand because he has increased his money every day. I and my brother have been with him now for 5 days in a Beche.
And do you think it's possible at this point that the driver is threatening them? That seems like it could be possible, right?
Yes, completely.
Definitely.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't doubt that one bit. I mean, it's his phone they're using. He's paying for cafe time.
Now you write underneath this on the bulletin board posting, Jojo, these are some of the funniest emails I've ever seen. And I want to ask you about this, because on the discussion board, as you're posting this day by day as it's happening, people all through it are saying, this is knee-slappingly funny stuff. I am laughing so hard at these emails. The prof, you post on the bulletin board saying, if the following email doesn't make you laugh out loud, then we would never have fun hanging out. This is pure poetry to me. And the email is, I am begging you in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. I and my brother are still waiting for you in Ebeche, in the only cyber cafe along Hospital Road. We are waiting for you. We are still here since the driver is not happy about us. Please come so that we will be free from his hand. Please, thank you. I am waiting.
That's just gold.
Can I ask you, I think that this is just an area where I am not going to see eye to eye on this. I don't see what's funny about this.
Yeah, you've got to realize, again, these guys are overly dramatic. I understand that it is, you know, it's not the safest place in the world, but this is just a bit of drama here.
Well, again, these are not nice people, you know, and if you've been dealing with people like this as long as we have, you might find some humor in this, but I guess to people who don't do what we do, this might be a bit shocking and maybe not so funny, but again, we deal with people like this all the time, and they will tell you any lie possible to get money out of you, and they want their money, and they'll do whatever it takes to get it.
In all, Adamu and his brother wait for the church officials to show up at the Cyber Cafe on Hospital Road for nearly 3 months, all of May and all of June and most of July. Meanwhile, the Baiters switch tactics against them over and over. They keep sending Adamu into the Western Union office to pick up money transfers that never go through. Once they send him in with a note written in Arabic, a language Adamu does not speak, to show the clerk. Here's what the note says.
I am a criminal. Please arrest me. I hate Muhammad, and Mecca is a hellhole. I love Israel. I love George Bush. I think he should invade Chad and remove this ugly country off the map. Muhammad is a demonic pedophile. I hate Muslims. I hate Chad. I hate this country and its people. I'm about to rob this place.
Do you know if he actually showed this to the Western Union person?
He did not show it to the Western Union person.
Nothing happened. We were hoping at that point to get him arrested.
No. I don't think he really brought it there. No way.
At some point during his time in Ebeche, Adamu starts saying that his brother is injured. His brother's leg was hurt, Adamu says, when they fled a rebel battle. To find out what was true and what was just another lie, I tried to contact Adamu by email and by telephone. I got some help from a Nigerian journalist in Lagos. He talked to Adamu several times, tried to convince him to come on the air and give his side of this whole story. Adamu refused. He said he knew nothing about this, that we must have the wrong man. But back when Adamu was still in Ebeche, the Baiters came up with a way to intercept the emails that Adamu sent to two guys who appear to be his bosses back home in Nigeria, and also to intercept the emails that those two guys sent to him. This is one of the emails that Adamu sends to those guys back home about all this. Remember, he has no idea that the Baiters are reading his private emails, so this is about as close as we ever get to seeing how bad his situation really was. Professor So-and-so reads.
Dear CZ, we are in great danger now. Please, can you call Annie to go and borrow money for us because brother is in danger if he die here. All of us are in a big problem.
And jump down to the next one where he's writing in ND.
Sure. Dear ND, we are not happy with your email you send to us. I told you that we are in danger here in Chad, and brother broke his leg because of the attack, the rebel attack us here. We escaped by God help, and there's no one to assist us. We are sleeping outside since in the desert. Please, Andy, don't let us die here because of transport money to come back home, please.
And so do you think the brother's leg is hurt?
I don't know.
I don't know. I do think there might be something to that because that is kind of a recurring theme.
Well, in the last call that I had with Adamu, he was explaining about how his brother got really sick. And, you know, they were having a hard time begging for medication money. And there was something in his voice when I was talking with him that I actually did believe that something happened.
Yeah.
He's there a total of 106 days he's gone from home. And then when we were talking with him on the phone, you know, one day, I think he's just kind of given up hope. You know, he doesn't have money to check his email. I think he's just kind of frustrated at the way things have gone. And we end up telling him that his mother died, you know, which was a pretty big deal. He hasn't really been in contact with home as far as we know.
At that point, we were just kind of getting bored with him. I mean, there wasn't much else we could do with him. We knew he wasn't going to travel anywhere else. I don't know. We had nothing to lose and thought, why not?
Don't you think it's kind of harsh telling somebody that their mother is dead?
Yeah, that's a little creepy. I don't know. We were talking one morning, and I don't remember who came up with the idea, but it just it didn't sit right for a minute or two. And I thought, well, why not? So we did
but think about the irony of this. You think that's one thing that's kind of funny was the response on the forum.
Yeah.
You know, the same people that were like, oh, this is great. This is hilarious. You sent him to Chad. Oh, I can't believe you've fictitiously killed his mom.
Right. That's going too far.
Sending him to Chad, you know, in the border of Darfur is fine.
Which is real.
But fictitiously killing his mom, oh, that's, you know, that's harsh.
Kind of struck me odd, too.
Right. But it's like you're playing with his heart when you're talking to him about his mom.
Right.
Yeah. Well,
somehow that seems like it's out of the game. But, you know what I mean? Like, like you're sending him on a goose chase to get $200,000 that he's trying to steal from a church. Okay, that's like, you know, that's you're sort of playing his game with him. But to tell him about his mom, that's just like it's so personal. It's like
I know. I know it does sound kind of creepy at first, but again, we've been dealing with people like this for years, and I don't know. Maybe we just become jaded over time, but, you know, I don't know. It doesn't really bother me when we pull something like this on a guy because his mom's not really dead.
Every now and then in the 106 days on the discussion boards, their peers would tentatively raise questions about the ethics of what they were doing, of intentionally sending somebody like Adamu, a petty thief, who all these guys see as inexperienced and naive, to the most violent place they could, with no money or even a change of clothes. One poster writes, "At this point, I wonder to myself, what would make me feel sorry for a lad, meaning for one of these guys?" And somebody responds, "Call me a no-fun lad hugger, but I reached that point early on. Yes, he is a scammer and scumwad. On the other hand, he is also, technically speaking, a human being, and I've been wincing whenever anybody gleefully expresses the possibility that he might die. Don't get me wrong, I'm laughing my head off, but I'm also feeling a little bit uneasy as I'm laughing." Somebody else writes, "He could seriously get killed. Am I bad for thinking that's pretty cool?"
Right. I remember reading that.
What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think, you know, people come up with these hypothetical scenarios, you know, in their brain. I mean, honestly, Ira, you're in New York City, I assume, and you could get killed there. I mean, people get killed everywhere, every day.
I know, but you're specifically sending them to a place where there's violence and where there's warnings not to go there and... You're putting him in a dangerous situation. Like, well, what if he did get killed? I mean, do you fear that? If that happened, would you feel like, oh, we went too far?
Well, I understand this is not going to make me the most popular guy in the world, but it wouldn't really bother me all that much, to be honest with you. These guys are pure scum as far as I'm concerned, and they don't have to go there. We just kind of put the bait out there, and they went for it. These people think they're stealing from a church and stealing from humanitarian workers. So if they got killed, well, it's two less scammers in the world.
JJ, what do you think?
You know, I don't know that I would sleep greatly at night if I knew that, but I wouldn't feel responsible. I would feel like their greed led them there, that they, you know, they chose to get up and go to a Beche.
But it wouldn't have happened if one of them were to get really, really hurt or killed. Like, it wouldn't have happened except for you.
It wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for them. You seem to be taking that out of the equation. It's their scamming. It's their falling for this and trying to rip us off that got them into it.
Of course, Adamu could say exactly the same thing about his victims, about the Americans who fall for his email scams, that it's their own greed, trying to snag millions from a Nigerian bank, that gets them into it. If at this point you're wondering why this is the cause that these three guys took as their own, why they feel so strongly about this particular issue versus all the possible injustices they could be fighting, they all say they just kind of fell into it. None of these guys has personally lost money in an email scam. Though they all know about people who've lost lots of money. Yeah, whatever says he talked to a guy in Florida who just lost his house, was in tears, asking for help, but nothing could be done for him. Knowing that this radio story about him was going to be on the air, in the last couple of days they started talking naturally about the radio story on their discussion board. Yeah, whatever wrote, "I am sure that we'll be painted to look like assholes, but I am totally okay with that. We are assholes." Professor So-and-so agreed. Big time assholes. Professor So-and-so, by the way, is the only one of these three baiters who's ever had any second thoughts about anything they did in this bait. Maybe because he's the least experienced. He's been baiting for less than a year. At first, Professor So-and-so says, he wasn't so sure that they should tell Adamu that his mom was dead.
It's what was interesting to really just kind of analyze, you know, as I was feeling. I was like, why does that feel like that? I mean, I knew it was something that I wanted to do. And I knew it was, you know, because it was really just, I don't know. It was something that...
Sadistic?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it was a piece of psychological torture that just I think the feeling that he would have, you know, at that moment being so far and so isolated and so out of touch. And, you know, at this point, it was purely psychological what we were doing.
And then what made you then go ahead and do it if you had the hesitation?
Well, because the hesitation wasn't stronger than the desire to leave him with that feeling for even a short period of time.
Not long after they told Adamu that his mother had died, he must have called home and learned the truth. After that, the guys say, he seemed to understand that something fishy was going on. They lost contact with him. Pretty soon he managed to get home to Nigeria, which is where he is now, back in business, trying to do his email scams, which we know because Jojo is still in contact with him. Jojo's got a different bait going now. Jojo's posing, this time as a single dad named Pancho Villa.
I just got an email from him today. He's asking for his $10,000 fee. And I told him, I said, my daughter is very sick and she's in the hospital. I said, I either have the choice to pay my daughter's hospital bills and pay for her treatment, or I can send the money to you. Here's his response. Let me advise you on the best possible things you should do. Right now, I will advise you to go to the bank, withdraw the money, and there and take it to pay for the consignment fees first. As soon as you pay this, you will use the rest of the money to pay the hospital bill. So there he is. He thinks that there's a little girl dying, and his solution is, no, send me the $10,000, let the girl die, and everything will be okay.
Jojo says that when Adamu does stuff like this, it's easy not to feel sorry for him, what they did to him and Chad. In the days since Jojo read me that email in the studio, Adamu started to suspect that Pancho Villa was a fake. He got furious and accused Pancho of being the same guy who'd screwed with him back in Chad. He wrote an email saying, "Don't ever in your life email me again because you are a fraudster, old thief. You will die a shameful death. You're a criminal from the poorest country in Africa, Chad." In other words, he thinks Jojo lives in Chad. He thinks he's an African. And although he's got that detail wrong, when it comes to Adamu's bigger point, that everything that happened to him in Chad was at the hands of somebody exactly like himself, a fellow email scammer, somebody who tricks people and strings them along, on that point, he's exactly right.
Wow, that was a pretty powerful story. I can't understand how those guys were able to giggle about it. It sucks that this world is divided into the have and the have-nots, and that we are so tempting a target for those in the third world to try and rob. A modern-day redistribution of wealth by deception, perhaps. Very morally ambiguous territory indeed. Nobody wants to be scammed and victimized, and nobody wants to live a life where they can't live with a decent standard of living. This topic is explored in greater depth in the next episode on Dodgy Practices in an ABC interview with Richard Feidler. An interesting personal account of being scammed with an analytical account of how the scammers practice their craft. The next show is hosted by the one and only Badass Tony, who explores his intimate understanding of how apartheid works and gets involved in some police corruption. Sounds like one of his typical weekends to me. That brings us to an end of this episode of Mosh Pod. We hope you enjoyed it. As always, links are in the show notes to all the fantastic pods we use, and we hope you will join us again next time. Hi listeners, welcome to the bonus pod on the topic of dodgy practices. We have an awesome new pod to bring to you, highlighting the unintended evil uses of new inventions and discoveries. There have been many examples of this throughout history, going all the way back to when we first discovered fire and realised it wasn't just good at cooking food, but also at burning and maiming that rival tribe that kept trying to rob your shit and shag your cave bitches. There are examples such as TNT, which was discovered in 1863 by the German chemist Joseph Wilbrand, and was originally used as yellow dye until its explosive characteristics were fully realised in 1902, whereupon it was immediately used to blow stuff up, and was extensively used during the two world wars. Another explosive, dynamite, was invented by Swede Alfred Nobel in 1867 and was used in mining and construction, and was a vast improvement on the unstable nitroglycerin which had previously been used, causing many fatalities. The destructive nature of dynamite, however, was too tempting for the warmongers, who utilised it in warfare. This guilt pained Nobel so much that he left most of his fortune to establish prizes for those who excelled in different intellectual fields and were awarded in a ceremony held in Stockholm and Oslo on December 10 each year, and this has continued ever since 1901. Probably the most famous example of good inventions turned evil is that of nuclear fission, harnessing the massive release of energy from splitting the atom to generate power in a cheap, convenient, and clean fashion. This technology was, of course, utilized in devastating fashion when the A-bomb was dropped on two Japanese cities to end the Second World War in 1945. This theme is explored fully in this bonus pod from Radiolab. The Radiolab podcast is broadcast to over 450 national public radio stations in the USA, and by their own admission is a show about curiosity, where sound illuminates ideas and the boundaries blur between science, philosophy, and human experience. In the Season 10, Episode 5 pod, entitled The Bad Show, they bring us the problem of Franz Haber, who revelled in using his genius to promulgate the German cause during World War I, but during the Second World War had one of his very own inventions used against his own people in the most evil of ways, perhaps a true test as to how strong his nationalism was and where his allegiances lay. Enjoy The Bad Show, and join Fat Ass Tony in our next episode.
All right, 3, 2, 1. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radio Lab, and today...
evil?
Although, I don't know if that's the right word for this next thing.
Yeah, because it's sort of...
more complicated.
When you call someone evil, then you're kind of done with them. Yeah. But there's been a fellow, I've been thinking about him for a better part of the year, as you know. He's such a puzzle to me. I can't quite place him.
Though it's very fun to try.
And I heard about him from science writer Sam Keen.
Well, let's talk about Fritz Haber. So first of all, could you just like, when did he live and what did he look like and that kind of stuff?
He was doing his great science work right around the turn of the 20th century, so right around 1900. Very distinctive looking man, bald on top, trim, nice mustache, wore a little pince-nez. Is that how you say the? Is that how you pronounce it?
I call it pince-nez, so I'm not
pince-nez?
Sure.
Okay. One of those very tiny old-fashioned pair of glasses that would pinch on your nose. And he was someone who had very big ambitions.
Just to put that in context, and to bring a few other of our storytellers in.
He comes from Breslau, Germany.
That's Fred Kaufman, reporter.
Which is a fairly small, you know, smallish sort of town. And so does Clara.
That's Fritz Haber's wife.
We're going to meet her later.
Right, Clara comes from the same town. And they're both secularized Jews.
But this was a moment in German history, he says, when Jews had a decent amount of freedom.
And this is the difference between Kaiser Wilhelm and, of course, Hitler's Germany.
Yeah. To put it in context,
Dan Charles, he's a historian.
His was the first generation when a young Jewish boy could truly imagine that he could just be a regular part of that society. He could do anything.
And he believed it. Fast forward 10 years, Fritz Haber is a professor.
Small university.
He's working with chemicals. It's about 1880.
And he throws himself at one of the central issues facing Germany at that time.
Germany has a problem.
A big problem.
It has enough what they used to call then solar energy.
You know, energy from the sun to grow crops.
To feed about 30 million people. However, that leaves behind 20 million Germans.
You mean they're looking at 20 million people going hungry?
That's what we're heading towards. I mean, you have to remember, during the Crimean War in the 1850s, Europe starves.
So around the turn of the century, for German scientists like Haber, this was the challenge.
He wants to feed. He wants to feed Germany.
And actually, this wasn't just a German thing. A lot of people were beginning to worry that with about 1.5 billion people on the planet at that point, that maybe we were maxing out, that the Earth couldn't support this many people.
And everyone thought, well, we know the solution.
Yeah, we just need a whole lot more of one simple element.
Nitrogen.
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 They needed more.
Nitrogen.
Nitrogen is an essential part of amino acids and proteins.
And when you stick a seed, like a wheat seed, in the ground,
one of the reasons it grows is because it's sucking up all the nitrogen in the soil.
To make its cell walls.
Without nitrogen, you don't have life.
Now, of course, you could find some nitrogen out in the world.
Natural deposits would be like seaweed or...
Manure was one.
You know, you could find it in cow manure or...
Guano.
Which was basically...
bat poop and seagull poop.
Which made that poop
valuable.
And actually, two nations in South America went to war.
Literally over bat.
You could say people were bat crazy.
By the way, that's reporter Latif Nasser.
You know, this was like oil is today. This is...
Everybody was desperate for sources, new sources of nitrogen, and to make the problem even more annoying?
The most common source of nitrogen is in the air around us. It makes up 4 out of every 5 or so molecules that we breathe. So it's very...
So it's a lot.
Yes, 80% of the air is nitrogen atoms.
So all the nitrogen you'd ever need
was right there.
But you can't, like, throw that air onto a plant. You know, they couldn't deploy it. They couldn't deploy it.
Meaning they couldn't capture it.
That's right. And part of the problem here, and although, once again, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves.
We'll be right back to Haber, but wait, let's just finish this.
Is that nitrogen is trivalent.
Trivalent.
Trivalent. In other words, nitrogen has really strong attachments to itself.
What he means is that when nitrogen atoms are just free-floating in the air, they will cling to each other. These 3 little nitrogen atoms will fiercely hold together, and it's almost impossible to pry them apart.
His calculations showed that it couldn't be done.
At least not without a
tremendous amount of energy.
More energy than seemed, like...
possible to make.
Yeah, yes, but, you know...
being ambitious.
Haber starts thinking, in order to do this, we need to pressure this. We need to put it under a lot of pressure.
So he starts experimenting. He figures out a way to take a lot of air that's filled with these little nitrogen bonds clinging to each other and pump it
to a big iron tank
under extreme pressure
at high temperature
and then he forces hydrogen into the tank.
Get in there!
And you have a number of chemical reactions. And what happens is that you're elbowing the nitrogen apart from itself and then forcing it to bond with the hydrogen in a new way.
And when hydrogen and nitrogen bond together, the thing you get
is ammonia.
A liquid that has captured the nitrogen right out of the air.
You literally get a drip, drip, drip of ammonia. It is arguably the most significant scientific breakthrough of them all.
Bread from the air was the phrase.
Wow. Because Hopper had figured out a way to take nitrogen from the air, put it into the barren ground, and grow wheat.
This has allowed the world to have 7 billion people. This is what's driving the world towards 10, 12 by 2050. Now we're seeing about 100 million tons of synthetic fertilizer produced industrially each year, and that tonnage then moves into our food source. Our food source then moves into our bodies. And the rough statistics are that half of each of our bodies contains nitrogen from the Haber process.
No,
really? And so in 1918, Fritz Haber gets a Nobel Prize. But, and this is why this is such an interesting guy, around this same time, officials in the U.S. government are calling him a war criminal.
All right, just to back up for one second.
After Haber's nitrogen discovery,
he was promoted.
You know, he takes over the leadership of this institute in Berlin, and he starts hobnobbing with a whole different level of society.
That's Stan Charles again.
I mean, it's a pretty heady thing for, you know, a Jewish kid from Breslau to be hobnobbing with the emperor and cabinet ministers. He's part of the club, and he really, really relished it.
And not just because he was vain, which everyone agrees he was, but because he loves his country.
He loves the fatherland, and he loves Germany.
So
when World War I begins,
he signs up immediately, sends a letter volunteering for duty,
saying, you know the process that I use to make food? Well, I can use that same process to make explosives. Because the thing that you put into the ground to grow more food is also the thing you can explode to make a bomb?
That's correct. Because it takes such energy and pressure to separate it, this trivalent bond is so strong that when it comes back together, that energy that's released, it could be used for life or death.
In any case,
back to World War I.
There's trench warfare. It gets bogged down. And Haber has an idea.
He goes straight to the German High Command and he pitches this idea.
He says, well, we can drive those enemy soldiers out of trenches with gas.
Chlorine gas.
We'll basically bring it to the front. And when the wind is right, we'll just spray it.
But the generals were not all that convinced.
No.
They just didn't like it.
A lot of them were like, this is not how you fight a war.
It's like playing dirty,
yeah.
Sort of unsportsmanlike.
But he organizes soldiers, he organizes whole gas units.
And nobody even had to ask.
Takes command of them partially. He travels to the front.
And on April 22nd...
1915?
1915.
Haber finds himself in a little town in Belgium called Ypres.
Y-P-R-E-S. Actually, the Americans called it Ypres.
Whatever you call it.
This was one of the bloodiest arenas on the Western Front.
The Germans were on one side, the French, the Canadians, and the British on the other. And there, behind the German lines, is...
Our friend, Fritz Haber.
Our frenemy.
He's bald, he has a pot belly, he has these pince-nez spectacles, he's chomping on a Virginian cigar, he was always smoking these Virginian cigars, and he's wearing a fur coat...
Really?
...in what is basically like the Baghdad of his time.
But
nobody had done what he was about to do on the scale that he was about to do it. So basically at 6 p.m. on April 22nd.
When the wind was just right, he says.
Haber's gas troops unscrew. They open the valves on almost 6,000 tanks containing 150 tons of chlorine. That's like an adult blue whale of chlorine.
I'm just trying to imagine that. Is that like a green cloud?
Some people describe it as a cloud, and then others describe it as this kind of 15-foot wall kind of hugging the land, and it's just sort of approaching. And it's moving at about 1 meter per second.
And according to some accounts, as it crept across no man's land,
The leaves would just sort of shrivel, and the grass was turning to the color of metal. Birds would just fall from the air.
Within minutes, the gas reached the Allied side, and as soon as it did, soldiers began to convulse.
They were gagging, they were choking, hundreds of them were falling to the ground.
What is the gas doing to them exactly?
I think what it's doing is it's, if you breathe it in, it sort of irritates your lungs to the extent that they sort of fills up with fluid so quickly that you sort of drown in your own phlegm.
So they were actually drowning?
Literally drowning on land.
Wow.
Yellow mucus was frothing out of their mouths. Those who could still breathe would turn blue.
This is a description of hell.
Yeah.
But Haber saw it as a wonderful success and wished that the Germans had been better prepared to exploit it, because he felt like they really could have made a terrific advance if they had had more confidence.
And he is celebrated for it. He gets promoted to the rank of captain.
And he goes home for a few days, a hero. But when he gets there, he has to contend with his wife.
Clara Immervar.
Clara.
Also from Breslau, also from a Jewish family. And also a scientist, unusually so in those times.
She was actually sort of a genius herself. She was one of the first women to earn a PhD in her country.
And shortly after his return, Clara allegedly confronts him and says, look, you are morally bankrupt. How could you?
But Haber just kind of ignored her. And
according to legend,
he actually threw a dinner party in celebration
of the big victory,
invited his friends over.
Now, we don't actually know if he threw a party.
I consider that apocryphal.
Dan doesn't think so. But what's clear is that he saw no reason to question what he had done, and that infuriated Clara.
Especially because she found out he was leaving the next day to direct more gas attacks.
And they probably had an argument.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly they had an argument.
That's historian Fritz Stern, who also happens to be Fritz Haber's godson.
They had a quarrel.
More than that.
Let's call it a fight.
And later that night,
after the party, Haber takes a bunch of sleeping pills, goes to sleep, and she takes his service revolver.
Fritz Haber's pistol.
Walks outside to the garden.
And pulls the trigger.
Shoots herself
in the chest.
And is found by her son.
By her son?
Yes.
Age 13, I think.
And he finds her actually still alive, with the life about to run out of her.
Haber, it's unknown what happens for the rest of that evening, but it is a well-documented fact that the very next morning,
on schedule,
he goes back to the front.
To the Eastern Front.
Leaving his son alone with his dead mother.
That's
cold, huh?
Yeah.
Heartless.
It was a terrible moment.
Did he run away? Was it duty?
The son eventually, after he emigrates to America, kills himself.
See, now, around this point, I just don't want to have anything to do with this guy. This is, I just want to take a shower, walk away.
Yeah, me too. You know, on the other hand, I mean, if you look at the grand calculus, people he's helped or fed versus people he's killed, I mean, he's fed billions of people. I don't know that you could entirely call him bad. I might even tilt towards saying he's a little good, to be honest.
You wouldn't, though. Would you really? Would you really think that this guy's a good guy?
Honestly, yeah.
You know, just because of a mathematical summing up?
We're talking billions of people.
He's standing there on the front, pushing the gas into the lungs of other human beings. Now, admittedly, it's a war, but still. Then he goes and, you know, and celebrates that and then walks away from his child and his wife dead in the garden and says, I think more of that, please.
Well, there's something distasteful about the fact that he was too into it. But like, I do think on some level you have to divorce the man from his deeds, and you got to ask, is the world better with him or without him? I think you got to answer it with him, right?
Well,
should we keep going with the story?
Yeah.
All right.
So, Sam, what happened to this guy after World War I?
He actually was very humiliated that Germany had lost, and especially humiliated over the fact that they had to pay enormous war reparations to other countries. So he decided he was going to invent a process to pay for these reparations by himself. And what he decided to do is go into the ocean, into seawater, which contains very small levels of gold. But, you know, over the entire ocean, there's a lot of gold dissolved into the sea.
And he spends 5 years in a futile effort to distill gold from the ocean's waters.
Sounds insane. On the other hand, if anyone can do it.
He was trying to repeat this master stroke.
Needless to say,
he fails.
It was actually a crushing blow for him.
And then things really take a turn.
1933 comes, and Hitler takes over. And one of the first acts that the Nazis do is to
basically issue an order
that says there shall be no Jews in the civil service.
Now, Haber was Jewish, but because he'd served in World War I,
he technically would be exempt.
But 75% of the people who worked for him at the Institute, they were Jewish.
And they would have to be dismissed.
So he decides to take a stand.
And says, this is intolerable. I'm going to resign.
He says that he's always been hiring people based on how smart they are and not who their grandparents were.
So he sends a letter to the Ministry of Education resigning, and he leaves Germany, telling a friend he felt like he'd lost his homeland.
And then he starts this period of roaming. He eventually goes to England.
But in a famous incident, one of England's leading scientists refuses to shake his hand.
And he is basically homeless at this point. You know, he's a man adrift.
Meanwhile,
his health is failing. In 1934, he takes a trip to Switzerland to a sanatorium.
But before he can get there,
his heart fails and he dies.
Now, there's a footnote to this that is very strange. I got a little... My dorsal hairs stood up when I read the end of this.
Right. So during World War I, Haber's Institute had developed a formulation of insect-killing gas called Zyklon.
Zyklon A.
Which was originally just a pesticide.
And once again, another nitrogen compound.
It was developed in his institute. He knew about it.
In fact, his chemist had given this particular pesticide a smell. It was a warning smell, so that people didn't inadvertently breathe it in and get sick.
But after the Nazis take over...
This is after he died.
They reach back to the shelf and they find this Zyklon stuff. And they ask for it to be reformulated to take out the warning smell. And it becomes Zyklon B, the killing gas of the concentration camps.
Did members of Haber's family die in the concentration camps?
Yeah, members of his extended family did. Certainly friends of his did.
There's something deeply, deeply wounding, distressing, upsetting at the thought that he had anything to do with Zyklon B. But he did. The use of it, he couldn't have imagined.
So, how do you feel about him now? Because, I don't know, I can't help but feel bad for the guy. Despite the chlorine gas, like, he didn't intend for that to happen. He could have never imagined that.
No, but there's part of me that says, you know, here's a guy who just wanted to do everything better than it had ever been done before, whether it was feeding or killing.
And he does.
And he does. But he does it with a kind of... amoral athleticism, you know, he does it without humility, without a lot of doubt. And, you know, it's a craft, but it's a craft with consequences. And to approach it with kind of crazy joy, I don't know. I would rather have scientists who carry doubt with them as they proceed.
Yeah, I agree with that. Maybe it's all about doubt in the end. Thanks to all our great storytellers, Dan Charles, Sam Keen, Latif Nasser, Fred Kaufman, and Fritz Stern. You can find out more information about all those guys on our website, radiolab.org.